Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. This podcast is for you if you have an insane drive to find the truth of things. It's not the good answers that we seek, but the good questions. I interview a range of different guests from many different fields, all with the intention to uncover the simple truths that are hidden in plain sight. Most people don't want to go there. I go there. My guests go there, and you benefit. Please let me know if you enjoy these episodes, and as always, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the podcast. Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. My guest today is Evan Brown. He is a copywriter, concept developer, author, and musician. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sounds like you have a very creative background. As I've been done so many episodes on AI recently, we can talk about AI, but one of the reason why I brought it up is there's so much creativity. It feels like the future is entering a world where creative people are going to be the people who really learn how to use this technology in ways that people who, I don't want to say aren't as creative, because everybody's pretty creative, but people who have like a deep connection with their creativity are going to thrive in these next 5 to 10 years. And so I would love to ask you, what is creativity to you, and where does it come from?
I think creativity for me is, and this is sort of a nebulous answer, I guess, but it's kind of what, how would I say it? It's kind of something you've never seen before. And I realize that it's like, we've all, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. I just wrote that in my Substack the other day in a post about this. It's always juxtaposing two different concepts and bringing them together to make something new. That to me is creative, right? So whether it's my music or as a creative director, copywriter, if I'm making an ad, I don't want it to feel like it's something I've ever seen before. You know, it's got to be something that's new or something that's unfamiliar or something that is going to move me or make me laugh or make me cry or feel something. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'm just contributing to conceptual landfill, and I don't want to do that.
There's so much of that. There's so much of that out there right now.
There is. And partially, I think we've devalued it by calling it content. Content is a word that I really don't like. It's just, it feels cheap. If there's a reason why the word farm goes after content, and it's just pumping things out. And you know, you asked me where creativity comes from. I know where it doesn't come from. In terms of where it comes from, man, I think if we knew that, we would probably lose the magic a little bit, because whether I'm writing novels or whether I'm making music, sometimes it'll be a scrap of paper and I write a line and go, oh, what if we did this? Like, I had this idea for a short story where, this was years ago, was kind of like, what if we could implant advertising into your dreams? And some dreamverts, right? And I wrote that, just a sentence, and then forgot about it. And then 4 years later, I found it. And all of a sudden, that birthed one of the stories that was in my first short story collection. Because that's the next thing. Everybody's talking about AI, but if we can hack your dreams, man, we can get you 24 hours a day, which is both frightening and hilarious on one level, right?
Whoa. Yeah. So the main emotion that I'm feeling from that is fright and fear and stuff like that. But yeah. Hilarious as well is in there, and I don't actually see it that far away, because I have seen the MRIs which can use the LLM technology to essentially read people's thoughts passively. You know, at the moment they have to be in these large MRI machines, which I looked up what they look like, and it's really funny. Because it's a giant machine that goes over your head, and it reminds me specifically of a big meme where there's like a brain, the kind of almost stick figure guy has this brain coming up out of his head, and the brain forms into a chair, and he's sitting in the chair, and this MRI looks exactly like that, which I thought was pretty ironic. But That's all to say that it's coming soon, probably. And that will, so, and how do you feel about that world?
I'm naturally a skeptic when it comes to things, and I let and it's funny, I was just having a meeting before this where I sort of defensively said, look, I like to poke holes in things. And but I also think that when you poke holes in things, and I do that with my own work too, it strengthens it because I can see where the flaws are and I can rectify that some way. When it comes to AI, when it comes to what we're talking about here, it's I know it's coming soon, and some people like to put a that time frame that they're like, it's 6 months from now, it's going to be so much better. And it's like, will it though? And how do you know? I mean, I almost bought an audiobook that was published this last year, and I stopped myself from buying it because there was this disclaimer at the top that said that it wasn't read by an actual person. It was read by
Oh,
a
interesting.
you know, and I sent I played a sample of it, and I mean, we know that, and I actually have an EP that I called Uncanny Valley, that it was one of those things where I created a Uncanny Valley version of a Seinfeld and telling these really dumb jokes about airplane food or whatever, and set to just this really stupid bass loop. And that's the problem, is that AI voice,
That is
it's
so bad.
just, yeah, it's just, it's emotionally bereft and it's very pleasant, but it's not, I would not want to hear somebody read anything based on, you know?
That's a good point. And yes, 100%. As a writer myself, it has been so annoying trying to get the thing to write because it responds in this voice that is just so soul deadening. But it's funny because that same voice often happens with people as well, particularly people who are really into what I would call scientism, what they would probably call science, which just kind of like, well, we don't know this. We can't really make any claims here because we don't really have enough information. We don't have enough science. And so they trained the ChatGPT, and I know how they did this. They trained the ChatGPT on that specific voice, and it's just soul deadening. The writing isn't good. I've heard that Anthropic with their Claude model are really focusing on moving away from that specific voice. And the what you said about Uncanny Valley and when did you create that Uncanny Valley EP?
Last year.
Okay. So relatively recently. And the deep fakes are coming as well. And what I think you're pointing to is a sort of lack of soul, lack of creativity, because the machine learning and the ChatGPT, it's just constantly recombining things. And it there's a huge debate as to whether it can actually create something new, rather than just because I think, and you were going back to your definition of creativity and your thoughts on creativity, that we humans can create something that's never existed before. And we do remix a lot of things, and there's definitely an example. There's like a relationship between remixing things that have already exist and creating something new. At least with the LLMs, I don't think that it's creating anything new. And I'll give an example, a specific example of this. I was using it to create imagery art with the DALL-E 3, and I wanted a monkey swinging from branch to branch with a chainsaw in its foot. And I wanted it just a tool in its foot, just to show off that, monkeys can wield tools with their feet and humans can't. And so I kept on trying to get it, and it would get the chainsaw really, really close to the foot, but it would never actually get it in its foot. And I think that's because nobody in hum no human has ever created a monkey with a chainsaw in its foot. So it couldn't actually take that new concept and create a new concept. There are rumors of other algorithms out there that do actually create new creativity, and it might be on the way. But I think you're right in that it's not here right now. And that's why I've actually been moving more towards using it to teach me how to code, because in terms of code, that thing is a super intelligence. But in terms of creativity, in terms of writing, in terms of all these things, it's actually not that great. What do you think?
Well, I was going to say it's funny. My wife is art director. We often work together, but she's also a programmer. She's a CTO. And she gets really upset with GPT because it'll get really lazy, right? And part of it is because they want you to do the premium model. But the other part is just I don't know what it is, but I purposely wrote something with a lot of spelling errors and fed it through GPT the other day to see, hey, could you check this for spelling errors and grammar? And it came back, yep, looks good to me. And it's kind of like, I don't understand that. You know, sometimes it'll do it and other times it just won't. So there's this still, and I, in the back of my mind, it's a little disconcerting that as a creative class, you know, and I'm not trying to get doom and gloom. I'm certainly not a Luddite by any stretch of the imagination, but there's a part of me that feels like we're digging our own grave by every time we get a better prompt to get what we are looking for in that output. So what happens? What's the end game look like when it's achieved everything that we need it to? Where is our we just become prompters at that point, right? And then all of a sudden it as opposed to, hey, I have this huge collection of work that I've these brands that I've worked on, these ideas that I've come up with. Now, if my job in advertising will be, hey, I can write the best prompt. And how do you measure that really? That's a little disconcerting. That's not something I'm looking forward to 5, 6, whatever months or years from now, when because there's always this sort of thing where it's efficient. We're becoming more and more efficient and it's going to do all of these things for us. But what do we then do? What are we supposed to do? Is it just, are we going to all be on universal basic income and all have, you know, just everybody has a Substack or what's the goal here? I don't know. That's my thing is I can see the benefits to so many aspects of AI for certain. But when it comes to creativity, that's still a little, it's a little hazy for me.
Interesting. And there's a lot there. The disconcerting aspect of it, definitely feel that. I'd be curious to ask you of what you're seeing inside your field of people using AI, how if they are actually creating work that's better. But there's also a deeper philosophical point of essentially, and this isn't new to AI. It's also just been happening because we live in this sort of alienated, technologically dominated world that's sort of, primary goal is that efficiency that you talked about, with no with about 99% of the population not really thinking too deeply about like, well, why are we looking for efficiency? What's the point? And so that's just like this giant machine that's been taking over for the past hundreds of years, basically, if not thousands. And now we might be reaching some sort of end state to that efficiency goal of like, well, like now there's a meaning crisis that people will have to deal with. And, there are many people who have already dealt with it due to various shocks in their life and stuff like that. So they're already in this world. But I think a lot more people are going to join us in this sort of like, well, what do we do now? Kind of thing. If you have anything to say about that, I'd love to hear it. Otherwise, we can go back to the kind of like thing, like whether people are really using it in your industry.
Well, it's a two multi-pronged, I guess you could say. Are people using it in advertising? For sure they are. The art directors that I partner with find it immensely invaluable because it saves them time. Because let's say we've come up with a campaign and we're looking for some sort of reference that doesn't exist, which is a great place to be because it means you're creating something new. Rather than they're spending hours and hours comping, photoshopping some sort of image that gets it. They can instantly write the right prompt and then they can throw it in there. What's interesting though, and I understand that from an art directional standpoint, from a design standpoint, when you're just trying to sell an idea to somebody with the understanding that this isn't actually going to be produced, this is just like a keyframe on a still in a storyboard, right? This is just the idea to get it across to see if you want to do it, and then we can photograph it later or we can film it later. That makes sense. What I'm finding though is that it's still sort of the Wild West in terms of what best practices are for agencies. There are certain ad agencies who are saying, we do not want to see that. We don't want you using Midjourney or anything like that. So that's one thing. So I think everybody still has to sort out their best practices and come to a conclusion as to how we use this. And I think that's a really great thing because I'm going to butcher his name, but you'll know who I'm talking about. Is it Jaron Lanier? The guy, he's written Who Owns the Future? He was basically the pioneer who created VR, right? And he's written You Are Not a Gadget. He's written Who Owns the Future, a bunch of different books. And what I love is that he said, where we start, and he's an OG Silicon Valley idealist and a musician too. And one of the main points he said is that rather than let technology shape our ethics, we should be using our ethics to shape technology, right? And there are certain companies that I won't name who clearly didn't do that and are devaluing artists in terms of royalty rates, in terms of book rates, everything else. So that's a problem. The other thing I wanted to say about AI, which I found really interesting, is back in 2018, I was working at the ad agency that does Apple's work. We had this campaign called Behind the Mac, where we had artists, we had musicians, we had photographers, journalists, you name it, from all over the globe, sort of explaining their process of creativity. And there was an artist whose name I'm unfortunately forgetting right now, but she was highly conceptual, but using technology and trying to prove that there's whether conscious or unconscious bias within programming. So, in other words, if you ask ChatGPT to do something, ChatGPT will sometimes say, well, I can't do that. Or if I say, hey, can you make this more snarky, it'll sort of scold me and tell me, well, just remember, not everybody appreciates this and blah, blah, blah. So it's somebody had to program that to do that. And so we're already acting like AI is this almost sentient being, but that was still a creator behind it. And that creator, and this is true, I suppose, of all art, is that you're bringing with it your set of experiences, but also your implicit or unconscious biases to that mix.
100%. And I know technically that you are absolutely correct in the sense that that's all happening behind the scenes. It's not that it hasn't arised out of nowhere. It was actually a specific technical problem that they had to solve, and they solved it in a way that is really interesting that I won't go into now. Yes, 100%. And I'm actually really excited about the open source world. Because the voice that you're talking about that was created with specific ideological incentives, some of which are conscious, some of which are unconscious, but the open source world is going to have a sort of Cambrian explosion in terms of people using this technology. Both, and I'm not to say that I'm not talking about a utopia here. It's definitely going to not be that people are going to use this technology in ways to really take advantage of other people as well. So it's not. No, we're not going into utopia. Kind of. It's like whether this might be a good philosophical discussion as well. It's just like whether it's possible to have a utopia and like heaven on earth type of thing and stuff. But we can save that for later because there's some really interesting things. Have you seen any legal challenges in your area? Are people getting litigious at all in terms of either suing OpenAI or suing people who are using AI?
No, I mean, I'll see things flash by my feed and on X, but n nothing specific to certainly not with advertising at this point. No, but I'm sure that will be happening. But and that's an interesting thing too, because you have the whole deepfake thing, which is understandably very unsettling.
Yes.
But I mean, a Russian company, what was it, last year, maybe a year or two ago, they had deep fakes of Bruce Willis in ads.
That's great. Oh man.
So, and that was, I believe that was, I believe that was officially sanctioned, right?
In Russia.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean,
Interesting.
Bruce
Oh, Bruce
Willis's,
Willis, you actually was okay with that.
yeah, or whoever is,
Owns
in the
the
arguments.
Oh man, it's such a wild world. So let's go, because I'm actually not familiar with the world of copywriting. I'm not familiar with the world that you live in, except at a super superficial level. And there's the AI thing that's really interesting, but there's also like the best practices before AI. Can you give my listeners an understanding of what it means to be a copywriter, what it means to work in advertising, and both, and where maybe the last, like, I don't know if we have enough time, but the last 50 to 20 years of the industry?
Well, first and foremost, there you have your discipline, which is, in my case, it's writing, or there could be art directors, designers, etc. But primarily, you're an idea generator. That's where it starts. So you're at an advertising, and this is true whether you're starting in your career or whether you're at a senior creative director slash executive creative director, like at my level, it's all the same. It's you get a brief that's agreed upon with the agency and the client. And you figure out your demographic. Who do we want to talk to? What do we want to say? What do they think about our product? What do we want them to think about our product? And then you're kind of off to the races and you start generating campaigns, ideas, insights for it, right? And then, because you have to start with the idea first before you can get into anything else, because otherwise it's more like, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but it's marketing versus advertising. Advertising is more brand level, it's more persuasion, it's not paid copy, it's more, but I'll use Bud Light as an example, or actually Budweiser, the What's Up campaign from 20 years ago. It was just a bunch of dudes hanging out saying, "What's up?" And that has become a part of our culture in a huge way. And that's a great example of creativity, because you can't, I mean, I'm sure I could kind of back out of that, reverse engineer what the strategy was
But
for
you're
that and
never
what the
gonna, yeah,
was.
got it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so you spend a lot of time doing that. You spend a lot of time, crafting campaigns, saying, okay, this is what it looks like in TV, this is what it looks like in radio, print, social media, whatever your media you're using. Then comes the harder part, or the next hard part, which is selling it through your agency and then presenting it to the client and getting the clients to buy it. So there's a lot of back and forth that goes into it. And then once you've sold that thing through, then comes the next phase, which is producing it. So if it's a TV spot, you're going to look for a director, you're going to shoot the thing, edit it, and then it goes out the door. The only difference, as a freelancer, I'm still doing that, but if I'm full time or if I'm brought in as a senior level person, I'm managing other teams to do that.
So let's talk about that. What are the considerations for why a company would have it in-house versus a freelancer?
It could be finance. It makes more sense to do it internally. A lot of places that have in-house agencies, like I worked on Lowe's for my last full-time job, Lowe's Home Improvement, they had their internal, but they also had an agency too. So there are certain things,
Oh,
it
got it.
depends on what they're going to do. It's not always, oh, we only have in-house or we only do this. Like Walmart's another example. I haven't worked on them, but I know they have an internal department that they're building out. I think in some cases, it just makes more financial sense. The downside, I guess, if there is one, is that you don't have that outside person kind of like challenging the way you're doing things. It's like, John Lennon was better with Paul McCartney, potentially,
Got
right?
it. Interesting. And that's the, because if you're part of the company, and this is why consultants can be helpful, if you're part of the company, you're part of the groupthink. And you can't, it's hard to get out of that groupthink, no matter how contrarian you might be. This is really interesting. There's something about like the branding part, which you mentioned is the difference between advertising and marketing. It feels really chaotic. Like, do our creative, I already know this because I know a lot of creative people, but how often do you run into a very grounded, who's got their shit together creative? Does it happen a lot, or is that not happen?
I would say that the best creatives I know are, I mean, grounded in a personality sense.
So,
for sure.
Okay. Grounded. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
But in the terms of the process of creation, everybody's mm-hmm. different. Everybody's mm-hmm. different. I don't want to get too granular, but I mean, even down to, I prefer to get up at 6 a.m, whether I'm writing, making music, or making ads. I would much rather work in the morning. I don't want to work past 8 o'clock at night. It's just not my jam, you know? So everybody has their own sort of idiosyncrasies in terms of what they do. But I think advertising is also an interesting one because you're straddling the line between art and commerce.
Yeah.
Oh. So there's only so, you know, there's only so kooky you can get before they weed you out.
Yeah.
You
know? Interesting. Oh, that's really interesting. So what is the difference in character between somebody who thrives in a role like yours versus somebody who gets weeded out?
Multiple things. You have to have a thick skin for starters. You have to understand that it's almost like baseball. If I have a 300 average, that's great, but it also means that 7 times out of 10, my ideas don't go anywhere. So you also have to be, you know, not just have a thick skin, but you can't be precious about your work because so many people are going to touch the work. You know, so it's you have to have this balance of being able to kind of know when to fight for the work and know when somebody's making a suggestion that's actually improving it versus a suggestion that will make it worse or water it down. It's a there's a lot of psychology involved as much as there is just creativity.
And how do you know when you have to be protective? I guess it's kind of like asking like a mama bear, like when she has to protect her cubs or something like that.
I think, well, for me personally, it's because of just my years of experience. Yep. And understanding it. But if you come up with an idea, it doesn't matter if it's an ad, it doesn't matter if it's anything. If you have that blood rush, if you realize that, oh shit, this is something really good, and this is different from the, you know, there's the difference between good and great. If this is inching towards great, then that's when you're going to fight for something. You're going to, you know, within reason, nobody wants to lose their job over anything, but you know, so you eventually have to make that decision of whether or not it's worth it. But I've been in situations like that for sure, where it's 1 a.m. and somebody's ready to kill an idea. And I'm like, look, please just let me present it to the client tomorrow morning. We can kill it. They can kill it. How about we let them kill it? But there's no reason not to show something, you know?
It's so interesting. I've been in a situation very similar that I won't go into, but recently. How do you know when you're the same question basically, but how do you know when you're itching towards great rather than just good?
I mean, for me, it's this inimitable feeling that you get. It's like, you know, when you wake up sometimes and you're like, you know what, this is going to be a good day. Mm-hmm. I can already tell. It's that you can't explain why you feel that way, but you just know it's going to happen. And when you come up with an idea that you know is a strong one, or you have a really great insight, or for example, if I come up with an idea and I want to do a sample ad, we call them ad-like objects, where it's like, it's not necessarily a print ad, but it's just like, hey, for the sake of our, this is how this would come to life. If I can sit there and rattle off 100 headlines in an hour, I know if I can picture the campaign still running in 2026 and still feels fresh, then I know that it's going to be good. So it's just, part of it is just muscle memory of having been there before, and part of it is instinct.
It's so interesting. And it really gets to the root of creativity, because it's like, we live in the capitalist society, so we have to be commerce oriented if we want to be successful with our work. But then you have artists who don't worry about that, and they just are creating whatever they, well, they do have to worry about it a little bit because they have to pay rent, but it's not so much. So I guess how, you know, and I've been asking you a lot of questions to define things that are undefinable, but how do you separate an artist from somebody who is good at copywriting or good at idea generation or good at commercial art?
I don't. I mean, I would rather probably flip that around and say, you know, you can tell an artist, you can be an artist in pretty much any discipline, right?
Yeah.
We think when we hear the word art, we think fine art. We think, you know, hanging in the Louvre or something like that. But it takes an art to do so many different things. There's an art to so many different disciplines. There's a, you know, I mean, Matthew McConaughey made a lot of bucks off of his little self-help thing called The Art of Living. And as kind of cheesy as that sounds, it's like, there's an art to living for sure. But, you know, if you're an artist, I think it keeps coming back to generating something that makes an impact somehow, you know, whether you like it or not. And in some cases, that's the best part. Is in advertising, you can make something incredibly polarizing that will win a lot of awards. And it's the same time somebody like Lou Reed can make Transformer that everybody loves, and then make Metal Machine Music that polarize the hell out of the world, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's a little bit of that. I guess what it comes down to is also not being afraid to fail or not being afraid to try something, because people can get really complacent. And I actually said this, somebody on Twitter said this, that there's a experience is a quicksand. And I was so floored by that, because you can get stuck from your past negative experiences, but you can also get stuck by your past positive experiences too. You go, oh, you know what? I won this client doing this ad when the, when I did something for Apple, where it was just, okay, we're going to interview really famous people. I got hit up constantly by different agencies saying, hey, could you do something like that for us, for this client? And it's like, yeah, I can. But after a while, I don't want to, because I feel like just myself.
Yeah, it's almost like shadow work. It's almost like personal shadow work. Because all the glamour, you know, there's so much glamour, and it makes sense. Like, the ego who we think we are is really attracted to that glamour, because it's all sparkly and new and so many rewards and such like that. But it's also not meaningful, not worthy after a certain point. You just get used to it. And you get cut off from that juice. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the technique, the spirit of technique, which is actually not my term. It's a term from a French philosopher called Jacques Ellul, who kind of predicted where we were headed with technology and this thing that you were talking about just like this AI having this horrible voice that it doesn't really soothe the soul in any sense, but just because of the imperative from the machine that we've got to become more efficient, we've got to do all these different things, that it just created this world that's like kind of just like ugh. But and that that is all really related to what we've been talking about how to find that creative spirit. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I feel like there's the sufficiency thing that we keep talking about, but what other people aren't really talking about is it's just a money saving, because we were talking about living in a capitalist society. Well, there's the conscious decision for Penguin Books to choose an AI voice to read an audiobook. Like, look, if it were a conceptual book about AI, I would be so down with that. But this was sort of like, why should we pay a voiceover artist when we can use text to speech? And to me, that's the, I just want to make sure that whatever technological advancements we're doing is ultimately not a race to the bottom for certain industries and just as a society.
And I actually did a podcast about this with somebody in who had to, because of the writer strikes in LA, had moved into AI, helped train the AI, and we talked a lot about this. And it's hard. It's a really hard question because it's really, and it's going to come at us really quickly, because as far as I'm concerned, the regulators who are going to regulate AI are not the going to do it with what you're talking about, which is like protecting people who need to be protected. They're going to, in my opinion, are going to do it in order to enrich themselves. And so like the regulation's not going to come from them. It really is going to come down to both the consumer and the person and the creative. And there's going to be like small groups of people who figure out things that really work. And it goes into my general philosophy of like where we're headed as a society, which is that the sort of for the last 60 years, we've had this monolith from television and radio. It goes back to radio and even print magazines before radio, of essentially one person with a lot of power, both economic and soft power and stuff, sort of broadcasting their message. And that is going away, and it's all splintering into really small groups. And so the things that I'm really unclear on is like how will the mimetic thing, the memes, travel between these different groups, and how possible is it to understand a lot of what's going to go on in these smaller groups? Do you agree with that assessment? Do you disagree? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly true that everything is becoming much more fragmented. Not just culture, but political as well. And that's both a good and a bad thing. Like, I was thinking about this. It's weird. I never watched Seinfeld when Seinfeld was on the air. And I remember being in a bookstore during the final episode. And nobody was there except for me and a friend of mine and the employees, because everybody was
Just
home
watching
watching Seinfeld.
it.
When was the last time we've had a great, at least in North America, a great unifying event? I mean, in Europe, it's easy because you have Eurovision and everybody watches that. And my wife is Swedish and we have to watch it at all weird hours whenever it's on to see it, right? But maybe some sporting events. I mean, you're in Argentina. It's like, okay, if Argentina's playing, you're going to be watching the, South American World Cup or whatever it's called. I get that. But otherwise, there's very few moments that are uniting us. Everything is becoming, like you said, more and more niche. So will the memes travel? They probably will, and they will travel with. But it'll make less and less sense the further away it gets from that particular group. And then there's also, we can't discount the normies who probably have no idea what we're talking about because they're not as online perpetually the way we are, So I feel like there's going to be what we consider success is going to change. In terms of numbers, in terms of viewers, in terms of stuff like that. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, though.
How does interesting, because it'll all just splinter in the same way. So the because we won't be able to sustain, and that's really where I believe it's headed, whereas we won't be able to sustain large organizations anymore. And me personally, I love that future, because I don't fit into large organizations. What you said about the event is really funny, because it sparked in me, you know, where I come from, it's the techno optimists, kind of. I have one foot in there, but I also disagree a lot with a lot of the techno optimists and the accelerationists, but that's where I grew up, and so I'm very much in it. And their cultural event is Burning Man, which I've never been to. And Burning Man, just like that particular niche, which is also splintering and moving all over the world, because it's no longer focused in San Francisco, is also sort of splintering as well. But that, I thought that was kind of funny, that there is that cultural event for the niches as well. And I guess that's to ask my question about how do I track all of these different niches. It would be essentially through those in-group cultural events that are probably happening in probably WhatsApp channels and small groups that are communicating and stuff like that. We've got our own happening down here in Argentina, which is really interesting. But I used to hate group chats, but now I understand them, particularly for small groups of people, because the sort of broadcasting is going away, it seems like. What are your thoughts on that, particularly from the advertising? Is that something you're thinking about in terms of advertising?
Well, I mean, you know, my mom was a copywriter during the Mad Men era,
Wow.
and you know, but that was in Pittsburgh, and there was one nucleus in North America, which was New York and Madison Avenue. By the time I got into it, that had already changed with you know, LA and San Francisco and all of that. And all of a sudden it became more fragmented. And in a way, I think that was really, really good, because I don't believe that everybody needs to move to New York to be creative. I lived in New York for a time and, you know, I didn't love the city. I much preferred Montreal when I lived there. It offered the best of both worlds in terms of culture, but the pace wasn't as frenetic and but I also think that, you know, it's funny you said Burning Man. I always I certainly associate tech with that, but I also associate it with South by. And I think
Interesting. Sure.
both things happened to that, which was when it was kind of smaller. And I mean, you could argue that this is true of the internet in general, but when it was smaller, when it was a group of people that all had the same sort of somewhat shared value system or what have you, that it was, quote, much better. But then as the thing grew and grew and grew and grew, it's the it forces people to be siphoned off to start this new thing, right? It's like that it can't it's not a question of replication, but it's a question of seeing what something has become. And for me, it's sort of like you don't need this is a perfect example of like it's you don't need to actually see an implosion for something to implode. It doesn't matter if people it's like Coachella. It's like Coachella is good here, but you know, how many people are still wanting to go and still carry that same sort of fervor as they did in year one, right?
That is a really good point. And that's been going through my mind as I've been watching TV over the past 10 years, TV and movies. It happens to both TV and movies, but particularly with TV, which is that it's like a sort of American pathology that we've created that didn't used to exist inside the US, but I would argue that it definitely does now, which is that we can't end things. We've gotten really bad at ending things. And so these TV shows start with these really crazy, you know, plots that are totally, you won't be able to wrap them up into something that gives us sort of closure or anything like that. And it never happens. And they just keep on going on and on and on. And at some point, people just stop watching, because it's like, this is doesn't make any sense. I don't like, there's nothing like, it's almost like the tail end of what you said about that you create something, this new thing, but if you can't stitch it together, there's no possibility to give a clean beginning and clean ending. Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that? What do you think?
I agree. I certainly agree. And I also feel like there's another aspect to it, which is, well, It's funny, we're having trouble ending things. We're also having trouble letting things develop, right? So I don't mean to keep using Seinfeld as an example, but I know that Seinfeld, the first couple of seasons, or let's take music. It's like how many bands in the 60s and 70s had to release four or five albums before they found their audience? Like Rush is a perfect example. They until they got to 2112, they released a couple of albums that just wasn't really finding the same sort of groove. But the flip side of that is you now have, what was it, Warner Brothers? I can't remember the movie studio, but it was Batwoman, and they're just like, yeah, we're not going to release that. We're not going to release that. It's cheaper for us to just stuff it in a vault somewhere rather than hope that it finds an audience and let it develop. But then you also have, if you don't get a certain number of ratings or whatever, we're just going to cut the show pretty much immediately, which is why you're starting to see these, like you described, like these outlandish shows that always end on a cliffhanger. And I suspect that half of that is just to hope that they can get to another season.
Whoa, interesting. Yeah, that sounds right. Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. And what is, I mean, is it just the financialization of everything that caused that? What do you think is the root of that?
I'm sorry, say that again.
What do you think is the root of that? Is it the financialization of everything? What do you think?
Oh, I honestly don't know. I mean, I always feel like there's multiple reasons for things. It's never just a black and white kind of thing. It's never as cut and dry as the media would like us to believe, I guess you could say. But, I also am a, I guess, techno-optimist in the sense of you were talking about open AI. And to me, this idea of utopia, like there's never going to be a heaven on earth, but the idea of utopia is at least a place where people are allowed to do things, right? And I know that sounds really simplistic, but we're also living in a time where people are afraid to voice opinions that maybe don't fit with the hive mind. If you're not a group thinker, I mean, I grew up, I like very kind of esoteric things and music that's not mainstream, and the my favorite cinema place here in a movie theater in Nashville is they show all the indie films and the foreign films. And most of my friends aren't really interested in that. And, but I love that. And that's what I think is really interesting about X, not Facebook, because I'm not on Facebook, but X is, I mean, this is how you and I connected initially. And what I love is I can follow whoever I want, whether that I agree with them or whether I follow people on the right, on the middle, on the left. I one of the guys is a who follows me is an editor of a Counterpunch, which is a pretty leftist magazine or whatever, and I love that. I don't want to be in an echo chamber. I and maybe it's the advertising background, or maybe it's just because of my my background is saying like I want to get to know everybody and find common ground. But it's also just getting to learn something that I wouldn't necessarily learn,
Beautiful. I want to take it just quickly in the last few minutes we got here. I think you mentioned Nashville. You also mentioned Montreal. I've recently found my spot here in Buenos Aires, and Buenos Aires is, like, for me, one of the best cities. I would say it's approaching New York in the level of how awesome this city is. And it's like a European city, which really gets me because I do love the European cities. But you mentioned Montreal, and Montreal, like, it sparked me as like, oh, okay, maybe Montreal is also a good Western Hemisphere city. Can you talk more about Montreal and your experience there?
Oh yeah. It's as close as you can get to Europe while being in North America, just
Interesting.
because you're in Quebec and you're French. But what I love about it is most people don't realize, but Montreal's an island, so it is a lot like New York. But there is a definitive divide, an actual divide between East and West, English and French. So you can be, and I didn't know this I moved there sight unseen, like I do basically everywhere I've ever lived. And I plucked myself right in the East, and it was a French immersion class because there were people that just wouldn't speak English. And then you go to the other side of the island, people there that greet you only in English. So when I was there, I was really fortunate because I was working for an agency that is still one of the greatest agencies I've ever worked for. It's called Sid Lee. They just anything goes. And it's kind of what we've been talking about this whole time. And they're like, let's get a bunch of misfits in the room and see what happens. Maybe 9 times out of 10, nothing will happen. And that 10th time will be amazing. And so I was working on Adidas then. And this is where all of these bands like Arcade Fire and Grimes, who were based there, were really taking off. And so, and you know this because you've kind of traveled around a lot and lived at a lot of places like a nomad. You know when there's a there's this
A scene.
this thing in the city, yeah, the scene, and you can't replicate that. And I know that if I went back, it probably wouldn't be the same. But for that moment and that time, everything was art was everywhere, and it was all amazing. You could throw a rock and you would hit five great bands you've never heard of. The food was great, and like I said before we started this, I was in Buenos Aires as well, and that definitely has that vibe because it is that European influence, but there's the Latin thing. It's disorienting in the best possible way, and it makes you want to go out and seek things because you know that there's going to be experiences there. There's going to be things you've never seen, and you know sometimes that's challenging, but it's that challenge that actually helps you grow too. And the trick is always like, okay, just don't get familiar with it. I like the unfamiliarity because that's there's and in, with a city that size, there's always something new to explore.
And what about Nashville? How did you find yourself there, and what are your thoughts on it?
Well, before, I mean, I've lived in, you know, I grew up in Pittsburgh. I lived in Atlanta, New York, Montreal, and spent 12 years in LA and Southern California before I moved here. Been here for a couple of years, and I like it because it's a big enough city that there's a lot to offer. But what I actually love more about it is that geographically, I can go everywhere. So if I want to see, you know, we went down to Oxford, Mississippi to see, you know, where William Faulkner was buried. And my daughter's in school in Athens, Georgia. So we drive and see her. And, you know, oh, we can get up to Cincinnati. You can get to so many different places within a short amount of time. It's weird to say that it's approximating Europe, but it's the same because it's like, you know, if I'm in Vienna, I can go to Strasbourg, just hop on the train. You know, so there's this added bonus of all of these surrounding areas too.
That's really cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And how can people find out more about what you're working on? I'm going to put the Substack you mentioned in the beginning. But if anything else you want to share, I'm sure my listeners would love to hear.
So my musical project is called Fault Tolerant, which is actually a computer, I guess, terminology. It's a conceptual music, which is fault tolerance is how long can, you know, how long can the space shuttle survive when there are so many things broken on it? So I'm applying that to music as well. How far can I push music till it's not really music?
And how far, what have you discovered?
I can push it pretty far, but I'm actually finding that I'm gravitating towards more structured music. So maybe it's just because the more I do it, the more it's evolving, which is fun. So that's probably a good spot, the Substack. And then my portfolio is evanbrown.vip if anybody's interested in looking at ads.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Stuart Alsop III. Also, don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or iTunes for every weekly episode that I publish on Monday mornings. Hope you have a great day.